call to order this meeting of the Commerce Committee. I'm not sure if we quite have a quorum yet. I'm going to wait to take action on the minutes until later in the meeting and move first to House File 96, the first item on the agenda, the Majority Leader's Bill. Ask him to come forward. So we are still waiting for members to fill time. I'm actually going to wait to make the motion. But we have a quorum. We have a quorum. How about that? So I will move House File 96 be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Long, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. We have made big strides since the passage of the Affordable Care Act in covering more Minnesotans with health insurance. But we know that too many Minnesotans still don't have access to affordable health coverage. In Minnesota, we believe that everyone deserves access to health care, no matter our income, age, race, zip code, employment status, or immigration status. And this bill aims to solve three big problems. First, it gives individuals that don't otherwise have affordable health insurance an affordable coverage option. This often includes the self-employed or essential workers who are juggling multiple jobs. Second, it helps small businesses that don't have access to affordable health care offer a plan to their employees. And third, it provides coverage to undocumented Minnesotans. Minnesota Care has been a successful public health care program for low-income working individuals since 1992. It was passed on a bipartisan basis to expand health care access beyond Medicaid to low-income Minnesotans and is a nationally recognized model. The Minnesota Care Public Option Bill would simply increase health care coverage and affordability by giving more Minnesotans the option to choose the simple, comprehensive, trusted coverage of Minnesota Care. This will lead to reductions in uninsurance, in underinsurance, and in uncompensated care. Here's how. First, the bill lifts the current cutoff of 200% of the federal poverty level for access to Minnesota Care. This cutoff is about $27,000 for a single person, or $55,000 for a family of four, so pretty low. These individuals would get access to purchase Minnesota Care at an extended sliding premium scale. The bill directs and empowers the Department of Human Services to work with other agencies to do the necessary actuarial analysis. It also directs them to seek a federal waiver to ensure that we receive a pass-through of federal dollars available to subsidize health coverage for this population. Second, it requires DHS to develop a small business public option for employers with under 50 employees. And third, it removes the current prohibition on undocumented Minnesotans participating in Minnesota Care. Currently, undocumented Minnesotans are only eligible for emergency medical assistance, which only covers limited emergency-related care. The exclusion of undocumented Minnesotans from Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and MnSure is a crisis and a driving force of uninsurance, uncompensated care, and health inequities in our state. Fourth, the bill includes an important step towards delivery reform. While Minnesota Care is a public program, it is operated through contracts with managed care organizations. This bill requests a report evaluating our current delivery system against other options in terms of the impact on provider participation, coordination of care, increasing health, and reducing racial disparities. When I was a young staff member working in Congress, I was there when we passed the Affordable Care Act. And there was significant debate over a public option. And unfortunately, it fell short in the end. But the idea has remained a good one, and it has broad public support. In fact, over 90% of Minnesotans in a 2020 poll. Healthcare affordability means access. It means also looking at premiums, deductibles, and out-of-pocket costs. We must ensure everyone in our state can have affordable healthcare choices, and this bill will be a really important step in that direction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Leader Long. It's my pleasure now to welcome back our former colleague, former Representative Jen Schultz. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. It's strange to be on this side of the table, but happy to be here. So my name again is Jen Schultz. I'm a health economist. I work at the University of Minnesota Duluth. My comments do not reflect my employer. They are my comments based on my expertise. So here we have a real opportunity in Minnesota to provide health care coverage for everyone. Currently, about 4% of our population in Minnesota is uninsured, with higher rates of uninsurance among those living in greater Minnesota, low income, and people of color and American Indian. But most individuals who are uninsured in Minnesota are white and are employed. Almost all Minnesotans believe that people should have access to health care, and we are so close in Minnesota to making this a reality. Unfortunately, it is not only the uninsured we should be concerned about. We're concerned about high cost sharing, called underinsurance, as well. The average deductible in Minnesota in 2021 is $4,200. It's doubled in the last 8 years. And 85% of Minnesotans pay a deductible. Average premiums are around $22,000, and small employers face 50% greater premiums and deductibles. And it's the lowest income earners who consistently pay the highest health insurance premiums. Even businesses are growing more concerned. In a 2021 poll of business leaders, large employers, 96% agreed with this statement that employer costs for health benefits are excessive. 89% of business leaders said they are unsustainable, and 85% believed there needs to be a greater government role in coverage and costs. Therefore, there is significant support for health care reform in Minnesota, and the public option provides many benefits. It provides leverage for purchasers and insurers to negotiate with providers as we see more consolidation in our provider market. It provides competition and another option with reduced cost sharing. It gives people more choices. It reduces job lock. It could help more people leave their current employer, get coverage, and become an entrepreneur. It could also help address our workforce shortage by bringing people to Minnesota if they have affordable health insurance coverage options. So far, the Minnesota solution has been reinsurance. The state has spent over $1 billion in attempts to keep premiums low on the individual market. But the state essentially has become an insurer by paying claims between $50,000 and $250,000 with little transparency or assurances from health plans. We would likely be able to stabilize the market, the individual market, at a much lower cost with the public option. Minnesota Care was created with bipartisan support. It has been successfully operating for over 30 years, and other states are now attempting to implement something similar. We should build on this success by allowing Minnesotans to purchase Minnesota Care and pay premiums if they do not qualify for subsidies. We can leverage federal funding, reduce our reinsurance appropriations, and provide more choices to consumers. The legislature recently passed legislation allowing folks to purchase Minnesota Care who do not have affordable family coverage through their employer. Enrollment started this year. Evaluating this option will provide valuable information to us as we finalize the public option details. I urge all of you to support the studies to evaluate the potential of a public option to provide coverage to more Minnesotans. Minnesota could be an example for the rest of the nation, and by doing this, we are aligning with the values of most Minnesotans who want their friends and their neighbors to have access to good, high-quality health care.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. We'll now move to public testimony. There's a number of people from the public who have signed up to testify, and we want to accommodate everybody. So we're asking testifiers to limit their time to 2 minutes. Mr. Brown here is going to be keeping track of time, and if you go over 2 minutes, I will ask you to conclude. What we're going to do is I'm going to ask for one person to come up, and I'm going to mention a second person who's on deck. I'm going to ask that person to come down and sit at the unoccupied seat at the table so that you can testify immediately following the next person, okay? So when you're on deck, come down then, and you can, that way things will go faster. So our first testifier is Angela Bowles Edwards. Ms. Edwards, if you could come forward, and then on deck is Jeremy Messersmith. You could also come forward and just have a seat. And Ms. Edwards, if you'd state your name for the record and proceed your testimony, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Angela Bowles Edwards, and I work for the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota, providing support, connection, and education to those impacted by epilepsy in the East Metro, as well as Spanish-speaking families across the state. I'm here today to share the story of 10-year-old Sophia and her family, whose names I've changed for anonymity. Sophia has epilepsy and experiences full-body convulsive seizures. In addition to daily medications and regular checkups, Sophia sometimes needs emergency care for her seizures. Standard medical advice is to call 911 if a seizure lasts longer than 5 minutes, because long seizures increase the risk of permanent brain damage or death. Because Sophia's family is still awaiting approval for an immigrant visa, she has no insurance. Under current law, her family does not qualify for Minnesota Care or any other insurance options. While Charity Care covers some of her doctor's appointments and medications, her family has no coverage for ambulance rides or emergency room visits. Sophia's mom shared that Sophia recently had a 30-minute seizure. As the minutes ticked by, she feared both for Sophia's life and for her family's well-being when the ambulance bill arrived. She loves her daughter, and she called 911. The hospital was able to get Sophia's seizure under control. Now, when she needs to be focused on helping Sophia recover, she's facing the stress of an enormous medical bill she cannot pay. The Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota supports Section 4 of this bill, which would allow families like Sophia's to access coverage for life-saving care under Minnesota Care. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Jeremy Messersmith and then Jennifer Jaco DeVries. Mr. Messersmith, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and then proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Messersmith. I'm a songwriter from Minneapolis. I frequently sing about kittens. And I'm here to support House File 96. I've lived in Minnesota for over 20 years. It's my home and creative hub. I spent my early 20s slinging coffee during the day and playing open mics at night. And for a few of those magical years, I qualified for Minnesota Care, which to this day is the best health insurance I've ever had, and why I'm here today and why I support this bill. Making art is fun. Making a living making art is a challenge. As an artist, my income varies greatly from year to year. This makes budgeting for healthcare extremely difficult, especially if you're someone like me who has consistently used the healthcare system for chronic conditions or the occasional collapsed lung. For years, I've been enrolled in bronze or silver level plans, paying between $7,000 or $10,000 per year in deductibles, premiums, and out-of-pocket costs. I've had countless conversations with fellow artists who have been forced to curtail or abandon their pursuits, not because of a lack of financial viability, but simply because they could not afford health care for themselves and their families. Minnesota has a history of supporting the arts, and culturally, we box far above our weight class. Our ecosystem gave us Dylan, Prince, and Dessa, why artists like Nirvana and Lizzo have done creative work here in our state. That's a legacy to be proud of, and I hope we can build on it today. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Jennifer Jaco DeVries, and then following, it will be Ann Schwagel.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Jennifer Jaco DeVries. I am a nonprofit consultant in the Brainerd area. My husband is a potter. We're both self-employed. We live simply and within our means, but we absolutely need comprehensive, affordable health insurance, and this isn't always available. I have a genetic kidney disease. After years of decline, when I was 41, my kidneys failed, and in August 2020, I received a kidney transplant. Public insurance programs like Minnesota Care helped us afford the care that I need through kidney failure, surgery, recovery, lab work, checkups, biopsies, MRIs, and echocardiograms. Now that I'm immunocompromised, I am at higher risk for complications relating to almost every disease you can imagine. Creating a Minnesota Care public option can help Minnesotans of all political persuasions. We're talking about small business owners and their employees, nonprofits, farmers, artists, the self-employed. This will help families all over the state, including our undocumented neighbors, get the care that we need. I often think about what we call the American dream. Isn't it the chance to start a business, work a farm, be an artist, or otherwise take a risk? How many Americans don't pursue their dreams because of concerns about health insurance? Minnesotans need the great coverage that Minnesota Care provides, and we need an affordable next step if we cross the very modest existing threshold. Creating this public option is an opportunity to lead on one of the most important issues your constituents face. We can fund a study to learn how the state could administer these programs directly rather than adding cost by contracting with private corporations. We can do this. You can do this. Thank you for hearing me out today.
Thank you. Next is Ann Schwagel. Schwagelks, pardon me, followed by Danny Lundell. Please state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Stephenson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak here today. For the record, my name is Ann Schwagel, and I'm honored to be testifying in support of House File 96 as the Vice President of Minnesota Farmers Union. When our members met in November, they identified addressing healthcare costs as a top priority this session. To quote one of our farmer members, If you could do one thing to make it easier to farm, it would be to figure out health care. We believe strongly that this proposal is a meaningful step forward to a future where no Minnesotan has to choose between farming, starting a small business, or getting the health care that they need. My family farms in Big Stone County, where my husband and I raise grain crops, livestock, and 2 elementary school kids. Much like other farmers, healthcare has been a persistent challenge for our family. For the first decade of farming, we had to do careful work with our accountant to limit our business and as much as we could grow, thereby allowing us to qualify for public programs. It wasn't a great feeling every year, but there was no way that we could afford insurance on the private market, particularly good coverage that we could afford to use should an accident happen on the farm or protect our growing family. Now that I have insurance through my employer, Farmers Union, I am terrified to lose it. And that, too, is the experience of so many of our members who are tied to off-farm jobs for their health care coverage. Finally, when I think of the impact of this sort of policy on Greater Minnesota, I think about our choice to have children. If our family didn't have health insurance figured out, that choice would have been unattainable. If we want vibrant rural communities, thriving rural schools, and new farm families on the land, making health care coverage more affordable and accessible is a crucial first step. I appreciate your consideration today, and I thank Representative Long for his leadership on this proposal, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Danny Lundell, followed by Lourdes Quintero. Mr. Lundell, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Stephenson. My name is Danny Lundell. I live just south of here in Cannon Falls. I'm a husband, father, grandfather, building contractor, farmer, and a proud member of the Minnesota Farmers Union with my wife, Mary. I have been self-employed since 1984 and have witnessed through this time the change in our health care system that has made health care unaffordable for Minnesotans like me, small business owners, and farmers across the state. When I started working decades ago, private health insurance options were hard to find but still affordable. However, year after year, premiums and deductibles kept going higher and higher. Buying private health care meant only having access to health care coverage that was too expensive to use with a $20,000 deductible, a $100 wellness stipend included with one plan was laughable, as it didn't even cover a physical. Then it became difficult to even find insurance in Goodhue County, located between the Twin Cities health insurance market and the Mayo Clinic market. We made the tough decision to discontinue our private health insurance. Mary, like many farm spouses, has to work off the farm to provide health care insurance for our family. She was furloughed at the beginning of the pandemic, and for 3 months, I remember the stress on us realizing if she lost her job, health insurance premiums would be $2,000 a month. Thankfully, her employer covered the premiums while she was on furlough. As for now, Mary will need to continue to work off the farm for our health insurance coverage until we're eligible for Medicare. Farming and construction are dangerous industries. Not having an option like MinCare buy-in is unsustainable and keeps farm families, the lifeblood of many rural communities, out of the industry. The MinCare buy-in would allow the next generation of family farmers the ability to live and work in rural communities. We have a saying in the country, talk is cheap, it takes money to buy whiskey. Everyone needs and deserves health care, and it needs to be accessible and affordable. Let's get this done. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you, sir. The next testifier is Lourdes Quintero. I understand we have an interpreter for Ms. Quintero. So the next testifier is Charlie Baker. And Mr. Baker, if you could just move down somewhere towards, you're already there. Great. Ms. Quintero, welcome to the committee.
Buenas tardes. My nombre es Lourdes Quintero. Soy líder de Fe y Justicia. Vivo en St. Cloud.
Good afternoon. My name is Lourdes Quintero. I'm a leader with Fe and Justicia, and I live in St. Cloud.
Estoy aquí el día de hoy para hablar sobre mi testimonio para apoyar a HF 96. Tuve una caída en febrero 22 del 2022 a las 10 de la noche, saliendo de mi jornada de trabajo.
And I'm here to talk about my testimony in support of HF 96. I had a fall in February 2022 after leaving my work.
Cuando disponía a irme a mi carro, me resbalé en unas escaleras de concreto de 5 a 6 escalones. Caí de espaldas y me lastimé mi cadera, cuello, espalda, y por tratar de no pegarme en la cabeza, fue tan grande que el golpe que perdí un poco aire y tardé unos minutos para poder levantarme.
When I was leaving my work, I slipped on some concrete stairs, 5 to 6 steps, and I fell backwards and hurt my hip, my neck, my back, and I tried not to hit my head. But the impact of the fall was so big that I lost my breath, and it took me about many, many minutes to get up.
En cuanto pude ponerme de pie, le llamé a mi supervisora para reportarle sobre mi caída y pudiese tener atención médica, ya que no cuento con un seguro médico. Todo esto tomó tiempo, más tiempo de lo normal, y fui atendida hasta el 7 de marzo del mismo año 2022, desde el día de mi caída hasta el día en que fui atendida.
As soon as I could, I called my supervisor to report my fall and get medical attention, but since I'm uninsured, this took longer than normal, and I was finally treated in March, which took very longer than usual because I was uninsured.
Yo tenía mucho dolor en todo mi cuerpo y tenía dificultades para hacer mis actividades diarias y en mi trabajo, ya que quedé dañada física y emocionalmente. Ahora, siempre que tengo citas y terapias, tengo que esperar mucho tiempo a que mis citas sean aprobadas.
I had a lot of pain through my body, and I had difficulties doing my daily activities at work, and I was physically and emotionally damaged. Now, whenever I have appointments and therapies, I have to wait a long time for my appointments to be approved.
Hasta el día de hoy sigo necesitando ayuda médica y sigo esperando la aprobación de una aseguranza. Ya voy a cumplir un año y el dolor continúa en mi pierna izquierda y espalda. Por eso les pido que apoyen esa propuesta HF 96 para que todos podamos tener un seguro y atender nuestras necesidades médicas. Gracias por escucharme.
And this is the final part. To this day, I still need medical help, and I'm still waiting for insurance approval. My fall was almost a year ago, and the pain continues in my left leg and back. So I ask you to support these health proposals so we can all have insurance and take care of our medical needs. I ask you to please support this bill to ensure countless Minnesotans get access to life-saving care. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much for your testimony. As I mentioned, Charlie Baker is next, who will be followed by Tavana Johnson. Mr. Baker, if you come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hello. Chair Stephenson, my name is Charles Beckering. I am a new grad nurse, and although I've only been an RN for about 1 month, I have worked in healthcare for over 4 years. I am here to testify in favor of HF 96. I have volunteered at the Faith and Justice Free Clinic for a year now, and I have experienced firsthand the need for healthcare for all people, no matter their status as citizens. For us, the public option, HF 96, is the building block we need to move towards universal health care. Here in Minnesota, one of the only ways for many undocumented people to seek health care is by paying out of pocket. This is not sustainable for anyone, especially those with chronic conditions. Once a month, for only 3 hours, I volunteer at the Faith and Justice Free Clinic to see anyone who needs help. And through this clinic, we see many people who need medical care. One of the frightening things we see almost every month is uninsured Minnesotans coming in for help managing their chronic diseases such as asthma and high blood pressure. For us, it is the norm to serve people who have run out of their prescribed medications and have no other way to access affordable refills except through our clinic. For us, it is common to encounter these undocumented Minnesotans going without or rationing their medications, such as their rescue inhalers, because they need to make it another month in hopes that our free clinic can help them with a refill. This is not safe nor sustainable. Affordable health care is a basic human right, and no one should be denied that based on their citizenship. As a health care provider, I ask you to please support HF 96, as this bill will ensure countless Minnesotans get access to life-saving care.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Next, we have Tavana Johnson, followed by Dr. Catherine Guthrie. Ms. Johnson, welcome to the committee. Come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Chair Stephenson and members of the committee, my name is Tavana Johnson. I'm from Austin, Minnesota. I'm a PCA and a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. I am testifying in support of House File 96. My late husband owned a small business for most of his life. In August of 2020, he was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. That was a very scary time. As a small business owner, my husband did not have good insurance options. Private health insurance plans for small businesses were incredibly expensive and usually included a very, very high copays and deductibles that provided very little coverage. If this bill had been in law, a small business owner like my husband would have been able to buy into Minnesota Care Plan. He would have bought a plan with good coverage and at an affordable price. Because my husband did not have that option, and because we wanted to keep investing in his business, he decided to just pay out of pocket for any care or injuries that he might have incurred, might require a doctor's visit. When he was diagnosed, the hospital told us that we needed to find coverage or be prepared to pay $14,000 upfront for every chemotherapy treatment each time, which was every 2 weeks. After a lot of trouble, I was able to get him access to a private health insurance plan through MinSure. The monthly premiums were upwards of $1,300 per month, which was higher than our mortgage payments for our home. The deductibles were as obscenely high, and that did not include prescription drug costs or copays. We had to drain his retirement fund just to stay afloat, and we did that for a year. Once again, if this bill would have been law, he would have access to more affordable public plan that provided better coverage. The stress of it all was almost too much to bear, especially while sick. I can remember thinking, how much does a human life cost, and who put the price tag on that? My husband passed away a little over a month ago. I can only imagine what it could have looked like if we didn't have to make the choices we did. Please support this bill so more people have better options. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and sharing your story. Next, we have Dr. Catherine Guthrie, followed by Leota Goodney.
Thank you for inviting me to speak. For the record, I'm Dr. Catherine Guthrie, a leader with Isaiah Faith in Minnesota and a family physician who has worked in Minnesota for 43 years, first in small rural towns, and then for the last 29 years in Safety Net Clinic, providing primary care and training the next generation of family physicians to all come to us in downtown St. Paul. I have seen firsthand many of the examples of the consequences of underinsurance or lack of insurance, and strongly support increasing access through to Minnesota care through the expanded buy-in public option. My story began in northern Minnesota as the consequence of delivering a catastrophic delivery experience in an out-of-hospital birth that led eventually to the death of a child. And that woman, who remained a friend for life, was one of the first 8 people to testify with Dernberger to get Minnesota care for women and children started in the 90s and testified at the federal level. The following 3 stories, however, are current real examples of the high cost of under or uninsurance, people whose lives would have been radically changed had they had access to the proposed Minnesota care buy-in option. A 40-year-old man noticed a lump in his testicle. He was employed but earning more than the $27,000 that would allow him access to Minnesota care, and he was uninsured. Afraid of the cost, he waited to get it checked. When he was checked, his initially curable testicular cancer was widely metastatic, and he survived for a couple years with both expensive and extremely extensive treatment and then died. A mother in her late 30s found a breast lump Because she was undocumented, she delayed getting it checked. While a state screening program covered the diagnosis of her breast cancer and emergency assistance covered her initial surgery, she had no access to the long-term health care coverage needed to manage a chronic condition like breast cancer. When she was lost to follow-up. When she returned, she had bone metastases. She will not be cured of her disease. She may survive with it for a time, and she has young children at home. A self-employed friend of mine was only able to get insurance with an extremely high deductible that she couldn't afford. She delayed testing for life-threatening sleep apnea because of the costs involved until she was in heart failure. On behalf of the thousands of Minnesotans who have similar stories, I urge you to pass HF 96 to expand the public option to include people above the 200% of the federal poverty income, those who otherwise face unaffordable copays, and undocumented persons who also contribute immensely to our state economy. No Minnesotan should have to pay with their life and their family's well-being for lack of or under insurance. I firmly believe that passing HF 96 is a step toward broader justice and health opportunities for all Minnesotans. We can and should do better.
Thank you. And next we have Leota Goodney, followed by Bentley Graves.
Hello, and thank you for letting me testify. I am Leota Goodney. I am a retired CPA and small business owner in Northfield, Minnesota, and I'm a leader with Isaiah. I support HF 96 as another option for providing affordable health insurance for small businesses and for individuals who do not have access to employer-provided health insurance. Over the years, my business considered providing health insurance, but always found it too expensive. In at least one case, we lost a good employee because we did not offer health insurance. Many of our small business clients in rural Minnesota struggle to provide benefits that are comparable to those available to larger employers. And as you have heard previously in this testimony, some business owners go without health insurance, as did some of our clients. Others of our clients limit the size of their businesses so that they can qualify for the subsidies on the Minsure Exchange. Our own family insurance costs have been high over the last 12 years since my husband retired from a corporate job. We are a family of three, including my brother-in-law. Both my brother-in-law and my husband have chronic health problems. My husband and I are old enough to qualify for Medicare, but my brother-in-law is still on insurance and paid through Minsure. His premiums are $1,063 a month this year with a $6,000 deductible. Between his insurance, Medicare premiums, and out-of-pocket costs, our total medical costs in 2022 were over $29,000. Through experience with other family members, I know that MinCare is a comprehensive insurance program that does not include high deductibles. This bill will give small businesses and their employees access to a high-quality health insurance program with a large risk pool. Please pass HF 96 and give small businesses, farmers, and individuals not working for large employers an affordable, high-quality health insurance option. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Bentley Graves, who will be followed by John Reynolds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to start by thanking Representative Long for the conversations we have with him thus far about this bill. And I want to start with an appreciation for the extent to which House File 96 attempts to highlight and address the issues that many small employers have in providing health coverage to their employees. The provisions included in Section 8 of the bill in particular would bring significant relief to small employers across the state, allowing these employers to claim a credit against their state tax liability for a portion of the cost of providing their employees with health insurance coverage would make their efforts to maintain coverage for their employees and keep them healthy and productive at work much easier in the near term. But we do have significant concerns about the bill's longer-term solution to the problem of rising health care costs, which is a government-sponsored public health insurance option. Government health care programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Minnesota Care pay doctors and hospitals much less than commercial health insurance plans do for medical services and procedures. As a result, health care providers' operations are subsidized by higher prices by those with private insurance who pay more to offset this differential. Changing programs like Minnesota Care, which pays health providers significantly less than the commercial rate, into an expanded government-sponsored health insurance option that's available to any Minnesotan
regardless of income, will lead to significant financial impact on doctors and hospitals, especially practices that operate on already narrow margins in rural and underserved communities. This, in turn, may further reduce access to critical care and services in some parts of the state. It will also lead to increased costs for those with private coverage, whether fully insured or self-insured, because doctors and hospitals will likely shift even more costs to these Minnesotans. These changes will only lead to significant and increased instability in the market. And you can certainly take my word for it, although I would also draw your attention to the materials that were included in your packet from MMA, the Medical Association, and also what I expect will be some comments coming from the Hospital Association about those two points. While we oppose House File 96 in its current form, we nevertheless appreciate the dialogue that we've started with Representative Long about this bill, and we look forward to continuing work with him, this committee, and other members to develop proposals that will bring relief to small employers and employees without triggering the kinds of unintended consequences that would follow from passage of House File 96. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have John Reynolds. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed your testimony. It will be followed by Dan Andreessen.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm John Reynolds, the Minnesota Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. We represent 10,000 small businesses across the state of Minnesota. NFIB opposes the creation of a public option in House File 96. We are deeply concerned that a public option would further compromise the viability of the private insurance marketplace and could ultimately restrict choice for small businesses and their employees. Public option, as Mr. Graves mentioned, would likely shift costs to remaining commercial market policyholders. In 2017, the Minnesota Hospital Association cited low reimbursements as a cause for concern. Quote, state public health care programs currently pay providers about half of what a commercial plan pays. More enrollees in plans that reimburse at government levels means higher prices for remaining commercial employer-based plans at a time when small businesses are already struggling to offer this important employee benefit. In 2018, the Dayton administration estimated a public option, then called the Minnesota Care Buy-In, would enroll 100,000 people, removing that number of people from the fully insured commercial market, as envisioned in House File 96, would mean significant disruption for the remaining commercial policyholders. Despite these projections and attendant concerns, other states that have recently enacted public options have struggled for much the same reason that commercial plans also struggle. Healthcare is very expensive, and finding a balance between affordable premiums, benefit sets, and attractive provider reimbursement rates is a challenging proposition no matter who designs the plan. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Next is Dan Andreessen. Welcome back to the committee. State your name for the record. Proceed your testimony. You'll be followed by Peter Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council Health Plans, the trade association for Minnesota's nonprofit health plans. We do appreciate the meetings we've had so far with Majority Leader Long on this bill because we share the same concerns about health care affordability. The council has been a longtime supporter of the Minnesota Care Program in its current form. However, before we do embark in expanding eligibility, there needs to be a thorough study of the impacts of such a proposal, even before starting implementation. And we appreciate the language that's in the bill regarding study language, but we do feel like it needs to be expanded quite a bit. This would include an independent actuarial analysis to estimate enrollment, anticipated premiums, out-of-pocket costs for all enrollees in all markets, as well as looking at complex interactions such as federal tax credits, which the state of Connecticut found this past year. Looking at impacts to the commercial markets such as stability, adverse selection, and cost shifting. Impacts to providers, which interventions such as reimbursement and whether their participation would be required in this program. And if providers refuse to take patients under Minnesota care, where are we going to see gaps in care? We should also look at the coverage and utilization differences between the commercial and Minnesota care programs. We do think that there might be some coverage differences between the two, so we just want to make sure consumers know what they're buying. And also making sure that we don't have any negative impacts to the current program if the state is taking on additional costs to cover this program. Lastly, we should not go in this process just assuming that the Minnesota care buy-in is just the only option. If we are trying to find new ways to fully reform the fully insured market, we think we should study all options. Start looking at what other states have done, such as Colorado, or also looking at increasing individual market subsidization. Minnesota is only one of two states with a basic health plan, and no other state has attempted this type of program in the past. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Next, we have Peter Nelson. who will be followed by Chris Schneeman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Nelson. I'm a senior policy fellow at Center of the American Experiment. And I think we're all here today because we all understand the Affordable Care Act didn't fully deliver affordable care for everyone. And in 2018, Minnesota established a reinsurance program to address affordability in large measure for a portion of people that weren't served by the Affordable Care Act. And at that time, I was working for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services as a senior advisor to the administrator, and I was in charge of administering these reinsurance programs. And I'm proud of the work we did to deliver affordability across the country on a bipartisan basis. We were proud to work with Democrats in Colorado, Republicans in Georgia, and the Democrat leadership here in Minnesota to make that a success. And the RAND Corporation evaluated the Minnesota program. And that evaluation showed that our program was a resounding success. I authored a report recently that draws heavily on that report. And that report shows that that premiums in the individual market were up to 36% lower for a benchmark plan because of that program. In addition, it protected 82,000 people in Minnesota. 82,000 people had coverage because of our reinsurance program that otherwise wouldn't have had individual market coverage. It's been said that that program was expensive, but that works out to $900 per person that was covered by reinsurance. That's actually very affordable when you consider the costs of all of our other programs in this state. And so right now we're talking about moving away from that program and moving towards a public option. And this is going to move us backwards, and it will ultimately introduce harmful distortions. Because the only way that this program can work is if it strong-arms the hospitals and clinics to lower their rates. And we have that right now baked into law. A provider must provide coverage through Minnesota Care Medical Assistance if they want to provide coverage to our state employees, to county employees, to school employees. And this will, as I understand it, this will take advantage of that to basically force participation with this program. And through that forced participation in this program, there's only a few things that hospitals and clinics can do to respond. They can shift that cost to private payers. They can lower investments, which will ultimately lower quality across our state. And some might even have to close their doors. That's not a place that we should be moving towards. We should be building on reinsurance. And that's, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Next, we have Chris Schneeman, who will be followed by Mary Krinke.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for giving me this time. My name is Chris Schneeman. I'm an independent insurance agent serving and advocating for individuals and small employers here in the state of Minnesota. I've also served on health care task forces established by both Governors Dayton and Pawlenty in the past. Today I'm here representing the Agents Coalition, which includes the four professional agent associations in Minnesota, which are the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, the Professional Insurance Agents, and the Independent Agents. Collectively, we represent over 54,000 licensed insurance agents throughout Minnesota and their employees. And we work closely with both group and the individual market consumers on a daily basis. The Agents Coalition opposes House File 96, the public option. This creates an unfair government-sponsored competitor to our Minnesota-based private sector plans. It's unfair for four reasons. First, the government has no capital requirements, as do private insurers, who must charge rates that are adequate to keep them solvent. Instead, the government can use the taxpayer as a backstop in the event that they don't charge enough premiums or they end up paying out more in claims than they expected. Second, the private insurance carriers also pay the cost of compliance with numerous regulations and consumer protections. Minnesota Care does not have to comply with these laws. Three, private plans also pay a number of taxes that state programs don't pay. Four, claims are the biggest part of premiums. The most significant advantage a public option has is the fact that government programs are notorious in their low reimbursement rates for hospitals and clinics, which must then shift those costs onto the private sector. To understand the magnitude of the difference between what private health care providers pay and what Minnesota care pays, legislators need just to look at the recently released 2021 report from Minnesota Community Measurements, which shows that commercial plans pay 207% of what Medicare pays. That gap has widened in recent years, since it was 179% in just 2015. A 2016 study by Milliman, commissioned by DHS, indicated that the gap between Minnesota Care and on-exchange individual plans was about 50%.
Mr. Schneeman, I have to ask you to conclude your testimony, please.
I will conclude that. I think what you're going to find is the public option will soon be called their only option, unaccountable to the public and offering questionable service. I don't think that people will be happy about their lack of choice. We oppose this plan and appreciate it if you would vote against it. Thank you.
Our last testifier who signed up in advance is Mary Krenke. Ms. Krenke, you can state your name for the record. Proceed your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Mary Krenke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I am here today to express a few concerns with House File 96. The Minnesota Hospital Association has long supported the Minnesota Care Program. In 2019, when the provider tax was scheduled to be eliminated, the Minnesota Hospital Association was one of the few provider organizations that stood up and said, we support the provider tax because we felt it was important for the state government to have a role in providing health care coverage for low-income Minnesotans. There is a section in the bill called Transition to Minnesota Care Public Option. Under that section, the Commissioner of Human Services is tasked with evaluating many things and making recommendations to the legislature. One of those items is what the provider payment rates will be. It appears that the public option provisions in the bill start regardless of what those recommendations are and regardless of what looking at the provider payment rates are. Currently, as has been mentioned, Medicare pays Minnesota hospitals about 80 cents for every dollar's worth of expenses, and the medical assistance program pays hospitals about 73 cents for every dollar of expenses. The additional challenge right now is that our payer mix is 62% government payment. So we are very dependent on the remaining private pay commercial rates to make up that difference. We often joke that somebody has to pay us above our costs. So as has been mentioned, we find that the private commercial rates are about twice the Medicaid rate. MHA is opposed to allowing individuals with higher incomes into the Minnesota Care Coverage Program. If eligibility is allowed to be broader, it needs to have a reasonable ceiling cap. Otherwise, low rates could jeopardize our sustainable health care system. There are some policy alternatives that I would just like to sort of mention today that could help lower income individuals better afford their health insurance. Number one, the 200% level of federal poverty guidelines that has been the cap in the Minnesota Care Program has never been changed. And maybe it's time to look at could that cap of 200% be raised. Representative Long mentioned today that for a family of four, that's only $55,000. It's really not. It's a pretty low level. Another option is to help people who buy on the exchange between 200 and 400% of the federal poverty guidelines. Maybe we could help them with their copays and deductibles. So in looking at this legislation, we would really urge that there be some type of ceiling cap. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Krenke. That concludes, as I mentioned, the list of people who signed up. I want to thank all the testifiers who signed up for your cooperation and keeping your comments abbreviated so that we could accommodate everyone. I and the committee appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the public wishing to testify to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion, but as the majority leader comes back down, we're going to briefly take up the minutes. Representative Cortese-Watoon, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the minutes from February 6th.
Representative Cortese-Watoon moves approval of the minutes from February 6th, 2023. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. We'll now move to member discussion and comments. Discussion to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will try to narrow down my questions to just a couple. Representative Long, I will start with just a more broad, basic question on current Minnesota care reimbursements. You know, often when we pass mandates on insurance through the legislature, we have exempted MinnesotaCare, typically because usually there would be a cost to the state if we didn't. And I'm wondering if you have, or frankly, if it even exists, sort of a document that would lay out what those exemptions have been and how that would differ from commercial plans.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative New Brindley. I don't have that list.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. We don't even know if it exists. I appreciate that. I just right off the bat, I'd be a little bit concerned with folks sort of being lured in by lower premiums and this kind of thing, only to find that maybe they don't get the same coverage that they've had on a private commercial plan. I suspect that we could have folks get into trouble that way. My next question would be, on Section 11, you talk about the federal waiver. Obviously, we're one of only two states with a BHP, and we would need a waiver to offer this to people over 200% of the federal poverty line. I'm wondering if you have had conversations with DHS on a timeline for what they think it will take to submit that application and on what data they're going to need in order to make that application for the waiver.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for the question, Representative Newbrindley. Yes, I have had that conversation, and we don't know exactly what the timeline would be. I think a year to year and a half was the time frame that it seemed likely from the last conversation I had. And the bill instructs that we construct the options to maximize the federal reimbursement we're getting from the waiver.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I would question then if it would take a year to a year and a half to go through that application process, if then going to Section 10 on that initial study, is DHS going to need that information that they're not going to have until the end of 2024? Are they going to need that data in order to make that waiver application? I mean, I have to imagine that CMS is going to base this decision on something tangible, not just our conjecture.
Leader Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Newbrindley. No, I don't believe they will need that data to be able to go and make the waiver application.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just point out then that, you know, when we look at Section 10, and I was going to ask these questions, but I appreciate some of the testifiers gave us some of the numbers on the reimbursement rates and how those things might be affected. You know, I did a little research myself, and the public subsidy on MinnesotaCare is about $536 million. That was as of 2021. And 88% of that is paid by the feds because of this BHP. 6% of it is paid by the state. 6% is through premiums and cost sharing by the enrollees. So if we look at just the federal portion of that funding, that's almost $500 million for the existing pool of enrollees. And I was looking at, I took the numbers from the public safety bill we had on driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. And the estimate from 2019 is that would add an additional potentially 81,000 eligible folks right there who currently are not eligible for coverage. So that alone would almost double potentially our enrollees of about 100,000. So when we look at these numbers, they're significant. I mean, this could easily get to a cost of $1 billion in no time. When I read language in here like on line 7.16, where there's recommendations for ensuring sufficient provider participation, there's only a couple of ways to do that. Either the state has to subsidize more, because as was testified to, the MinnesotaCare rates of reimbursement are not enough to cover costs. And right now, the private plans, the commercial plans, pick up that difference to ensure that our providers can continue to function. And so I get concerned when I see this language that we have to ensure sufficient provider participation. I mean, there's only a couple of ways to do that, right? To meet these demands, we either have to decrease what we're giving to providers or we have to increase the subsidy. And either way, that becomes quite expensive to the state. And I'd be very, very concerned about what that means for providers. You know, I mean, I have a brother-in-law who's a neurologist who left the state a couple of years ago because he didn't have to practice here. And so he moved on to Colorado, where he did very well for himself, and now he's moved on to Kansas, where he's doing even better. I worry about what we will do to our provider pool when we are likely decreasing their reimbursement rates. And frankly, I mean, as our state demographer has pointed out, we're already losing population. We've lost 20,000 Minnesotans the last 2 years. This is enormously concerning. And if we are losing people like the providers who aren't just providing our healthcare, that unbelievably valuable service, but they're also providing a huge contribution to our tax base. They're paying the provider tax, which is paying the state portion currently of Minnesota Care. I mean, right now, the state's portion of that 6% is coming from the provider tax and the premium tax on health plans. There's just so many moving pieces with this that are really, really concerning. I worry about the timelines, certainly to get that federal waiver. And I worry that this is set up as not just a study, but an implementation plan, regardless of what that study says. So if we have a study that comes back and says, this is gonna be $1 billion, $1.5 billion, $2 billion, well, there's no brakes on this legislation. The implementation is going to happen. We're just going to have to figure it out. That is extraordinarily concerning that we're not doing the due diligence of getting that information before we make these decisions to move forward. All we're doing is getting the information to decide how we will move forward, not if this is the best way to serve Minnesotans. I think that there are a lot of real world concerns with this language that should be considered before moving forward, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, former Representative Schultz and Representative Long, for bringing this forward. So I represent Plymouth and Medicine Lake. In Plymouth and Medicine Lake, we have a lot of self-employed individuals, and we have people who have been gainfully employed and have found themselves the victims of age discrimination once they hit the employment age of 55 to 58. This is a real problem in our state, and many of these individuals no longer show up on even in the employable roles anymore. And I was just looking at the numbers that 13.4% of Minnesotans between the age of 55 and 64 are without employment. Oh, that's about 230 people without employment, 30,000 people without employment in that age bracket of 55 to 64. Is that those individuals would be able to buy into Minnesota Care? Is that correct?
Leader Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might defer to our health economist for the specifics on that pool.
Former Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative Cleaver. Yes, they would be eligible based on how the bill is currently written.
So these people.
Representative Cleaver.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So these are individuals who have been involuntarily removed from employment and involuntarily without insurance. So that would be a market that would actually be served. And then my question is, when we are thinking about individuals that would need coverage, I mean, I'm thinking about my own premiums. So when I was self-employed, and that number I believe is 762,000 Minnesotans are self-employed, something like that. I paid personally $1,500 a month, and my husband and I jointly had a $28,000 a year deductible, right? So I looked at that and said, okay, in our 10-year period, we're looking at $250,000. It's unsustainable. I mean, these numbers are real, and I have a very comfortable life, and it was unreal. So it's not that we are trying to take individuals from a market that is currently serving them well, but that these are individuals who find themselves in the independent market, which is not sustainable for most. Is that correct?
Leader Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Absolutely. I've heard from many individuals in my district who are self-employed and either can't make it work for the numbers and the cost structures that you've shared, or they have to rely on a spouse. And as we heard from some of the testifiers, that doesn't always work out, and you might lose your spouse's employment coverage. Or they are forced to take a job just for the health insurance so that they can do the other things that they are good at, are skilled at, want to create in the community, in the world. So it is an extremely big challenge for folks who are in that self-employed bracket and don't have options right now that are affordable, either on the premium side or often more likely on the deductible side and the out-of-pocket costs.
Okay, and one last statement. So my last statement is this, and when my husband and I would negotiate our insurance plan, we would pick a silver plan. It wasn't the best, but still it was what we could afford to do. What I wasn't aware of at the time is that our policy rates changed three times of the year. It changed on January when the new plan would go into place, so we'd get those rates in October. And then it would change with his birth date, and it would change with my birth date. So just trying to figure out what our rates would be was very complicated. So I thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Representative King.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I worked at an organization in my former life where we had Head Start programming there. And the kids that come through the Head Start programming, you know, get dental work, and they would get their screenings, and they would get health care. And so when I'm looking at Section 7 of the bill, the sliding fee scale, that to me is going to be such a huge deal to working families. I think about, you know, if your kids are getting three meals a day and getting their dental checkups, and your boss offers you a promotion, but then your kid is losing out on all those benefits, I don't know what you would do, but I wouldn't probably take it. And so, you know, we're really penalizing people for keeping these benefits. And so I see this as a really great program that can help people transition up out of poverty without having to risk losing their health care and lose, you know, being able to care for their family. And so this to me is just one of those things that we can do to help people up, give them a hand up, and help them get back on their feet. And so I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Long, the author of the bill. I have a series of questions for you, sir. First question I have for you is, in the bill, we talk about monthly premiums, and many of the testifiers talked about the $50 a month premium that's on here. Do you have any kind of an idea in the works that you've been doing on this where premiums would go if we ended up with additional individuals who are going to be taking advantage of the Minnesota Care who either A, don't have care, or B, would leave a commercial plan?
Leader Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. So the bill instructs the agencies to develop the premium scale, and for those who are currently under the eligibility guidelines for the income thresholds now, it would stay the same as what it is under Minnesota Care. In terms of the projections, I'd defer to Dr. Schultz if she has any thoughts to add on that.
Dr. Schultz?
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative O'Driscoll. I've done some back-of-the-envelope analysis, but it's not ready for prime time. But I'm happy, Representative, to meet with you and go over my initial estimates. But we're going to need more actuarial analysis, and I think we're going to learn a lot when we fix the family glitch in Minnesota ahead of the federal government.
we're going to learn a lot about individuals who went through that door to get coverage in Minnesota Care, and then the federal fix to the family glitch, they're eligible for the QHPs on Minsure. So we're going to learn a lot from them as well.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Long, or former Representative, and Dr. Schultz, however we want to refer to you today, both titles today. There are a number of hospitals between where I live and where you live in Duluth and where I live in the St. Cloud area. Those are rural hospitals, and they're barely hanging on right now because what we do know is that Medicare reimbursement does not cover the actual costs of care. We know that Minnesota Care doesn't cover the actual costs of care. What helps to be able to leave and allow these hospitals to be open in greater Minnesota is the commercial market, because they actually end up paying the full freight and then some to be able to make this process work. What is the plan if premiums and the commercial market, we lose persons in the commercial market going to a plan that does not provide subsidy for the full services that are being given in these hospitals? They close, and now the folks who are here today talking about trying to get coverage cannot even have a place to go because they have to go out of business as the local providers.
Leave it alone.
Looked like the question was directed
to Dr. Schultz. Dr. Schultz.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear from both of them if I could.
Sure.
I'm an equal opportunity.
Sure. I'll go ahead first. So I think the part that your question is leaving out is uncompensated care. And so you certainly are identifying a legitimate concern about what the impact will be on the market, and that's something that we are having the agencies take a look at. But there is a large amount of uncompensated care that the hospitals are also having to pay that comes from folks who are not insured, folks who are undocumented, folks who are underinsured. And this is going to help bring a lot of those folks into a position where they will be reimbursement for the hospitals, where there will be payment. So there's been an assumption that it only works one direction, and that's not accurate.
Dr. Schultz, anything to add?
Yeah. So, you know, our system is broken in the United States. We spend $4.3 trillion on health care every year. We spend twice as much per person compared to other wealthy countries. And the reason we spend more is because of our high prices, provider prices. We need to subsidize rural hospitals and providers so they can continue to serve rural populations. That is a priority. They're going to need subsidies at the federal level as well to continue to serve because they have lower populations to serve. So they have a different revenue model than urban metro-based hospitals. But we don't know what their actual costs are. That's the problem. We say that their costs are high. We have no idea what their costs are. It doesn't make sense to charge different prices based on who's paying, which insurer is covering it. It's basically right now based on their ability to negotiate and bargain and who has the most leverage. And as hospitals continue to consolidate in Minnesota and across the country, insurers have less leverage to negotiate more reasonable reimbursement and prices. So we need more transparency there, and I think that should have bipartisan support as it has in the past. And we need to pass a bill similar to what 9 other states are doing, and Massachusetts has had for a while affordability board. Massachusetts has saved $9 billion over 5 years by trying to uncover what the actual health care costs are and working with providers on the growth of those health care costs.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad that Dr. Schultz brought up the idea of urban hospitals versus rural hospitals, because not all that long ago in front of this committee, there was the principals who were involved in a potential merger that's in an urban area, and that's Fairview and Sanford. And just again for those assembled here, the University of Minnesota Hospitals wanted to get out of the business, and they struck a deal with Fairview. And Fairview is experiencing some of the same kinds of legacy issues that the University of Minnesota Hospitals did. They're trying to strike a deal with Sanford, and there was legislation that was passed out of this committee that would slow that process down and basically interfere with private negotiations as a legislature on this. And it is not just a rural issue, it is an urban issue. And I have said this before and I'll say it again. We could find ourselves in a situation where Fairview could end up closing their doors because they can't find a merger partner, and the only merger partner that stepped up was Sanford. thus leaving a lot of other individuals, whether they're in the commercial market or whether they're in a subsidized market, no health care because there is no facility because they went out of business. And then that's very concerning to me, that we are really shifting the field right now of how we're dealing with this. This is a very difficult game to play. When I say game to play, I'm exactly with you, Representative Schultz. It's complex. It needs work. And moving too many pieces too fast can really upset the apple cart, in my opinion. And I think I've got statistics over time to prove that. Because in 2013 and 2014, the then majority leader and now Senator Murphy wanted to make sure that schools and public schools, when they began their health care negotiations, accepted a bid from PEEP, another public health option. What ended up happening is for the first year or two, PEEP had very competitive rates. Then when they got a chance to see what the actual costs were, the next year's set of premiums came out, and they wanted out. Schools wanted out, but they had to be in for at least 3 years. The cost to our public schools for those schools that chose PEEP skyrocketed. I fear that this is what's going to happen to individuals who pay $50 or $100 or $175 a month. Eventually becomes unaffordable for them again. And if individuals leave the public or commercial market, rather, that commercial market becomes smaller. That commercial market may not be able to have the capacity to take people back into it because of reorganization and restructuring. We've got to think beyond where we are right now and how we're going to be working with this. And so, Mr. Chair, I would recommend today that individuals, either one of two things, we slow this down, or if we do need to vote this out of committee, I strongly encourage a no vote because we have a lot of unanswered questions, those provided by the bill author that my colleagues have asked, unsure of the difference between what benefits are covered and are not covered. For individuals testifying today, here's my situation, here's my ailment. We don't even have a list to know whether those are covered or not covered for those individuals in Minnesota Care. They are making life and death decisions. I don't think that we should complicate that situation by moving legislation too quickly. I think we have to have more transparency here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Majority Leader Long, I will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Minnesota Care is an excellent health insurance program that has been operating in our state for over 30 years. And I think you heard from some individuals today that are on Minnesota Care, have been on Minnesota Care, and really value the coverage. And it is good coverage. We know that we have a nation-leading program here in the state in Minnesota Care. This is not an approach that other states are taking because they can't. They don't have the ability to build on what we have here in Minnesota with Minnesota Care. And so we have a unique opportunity to solve the very real, very difficult, very challenging problems that you heard from testifier after testifier today, heartbreaking stories about individuals who do not have currently affordable options for health care. This bill would go a long way to helping with individuals, helping with small businesses, and helping with our undocumented residents in Minnesota to make sure they do have that option and to make sure that they are getting the care they need at an affordable price. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I urge the committee's support.
Thank you, Majority Leader Long. I will renew my motion that House File 96 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 96 is recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Majority Leader Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I imagine there are many people in the audience who are going to get up now and leave, and that's totally fine. We do have one other bill on the agenda and limited time, so I'm going to ask the audience to please... I'm going to ask the audience to please take your conversations outside and be quiet as you leave the room so that the committee can continue with its work. Thank you very much. The next item on our agenda is House File 1243 from Representative Brand. I will move House File 1243 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Brand, to your bill.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. House File 1243 is an important next step in Minnesota as we are on the heels of the passage of the Student Loan Borrowers Bill of Rights in 2021. This bill is as much an educational opportunity for students thinking of higher education as much as it is for prevention by giving the Department of Commerce the ability to protect borrowers with their rights have been violated by a lender, or if they have questions, or if they're trying to petition some resolution on an issue with their loan, their student loan. Last year, this bill was heard in committee. Chair Stevenson was the author of the bill. It was laid over for possible inclusion, but was not actually in the final bill. Last year, there was a request for a fiscal note, and they came back with one. We had one this year. It looks a little different, which I appreciate for how fast we got the fiscal note, but also how efficient it was in terms of what the actual needs are for the Department of Commerce going forward. There is no appropriation in my bill right now. However, I've been assured by the chair that there is a budget for this in the upcoming committee budget proposal. Right now, Minnesota ranks fifth when we're talking about in the nation for student debt. The average student debt is over $30,000 per borrower. I personally have student debt from when I went to college. So does my wife. This bill would allow better information for new but also existing borrowers about talking about loans and preparing them to pay those loans back. And I will stop right here and allow my testifier to come up and give you more information.
Thank you, Representative Brand. We do have one person who signed up to testify, David Rondesvet. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is David Rondesvet. I'm a special education teacher at Robbinsdale Armstrong High School. I've taught for the past 35 years, and I currently work with students in our center-based special education program, which supports students with mild to moderate handicaps develop functional living skills to prepare for future independence. I'm here to support this bill and the creation of a student loan advocate here in Minnesota. Without having support and assistance in navigating an incredibly difficult student loan repayment system, borrowers like my colleagues and I will continue to struggle under the weight of loans that we pay back for years only to find that our balance grows and our economic stability suffers. I want to share a little story of mine relating to student loans. As educators, some of my colleagues and I are eligible for a program called Public Service Loan Forgiveness, which forgives our loan balance after 10 years of steady repayments on specific repayment plans. In 2007, I began repaying loans from graduate school. At no time did any of the loan servicing companies that I paid each month tell me that I could be eligible for loan forgiveness. At no time did they advise me about what steps I would need to take or what options I might have available to help me with get on track for loan forgiveness. I repaid my loan steadily from 2007 until they could have been forgiven in 2017, and I continued to pay beyond that period. It was only after training and support from my union that I knew there was an option for me to apply for loan forgiveness last year. I have colleagues who have experienced far worse when it comes to lenders and loan servicing companies. There are folks whose loan payment information has been lost by their servicers, impacting their credit scores and their financial security. There are folks who have not been able to get any information from lenders about their own debt, causing them to miss payments and default. There are folks who don't know they have ways to make loan payments more affordable. One of the hardest things to see is that I have friends who were advised to refinance their debt into private loans, and these folks are no longer eligible for any kind of loan forgiveness and are subject to the difficult private lending rules. None of this is fair or right. Every Minnesotan deserves to have accurate information on loan repayment options. Every Minnesotan deserves the financial security that comes from having an even playing field so they can repay their debts and build for a strong financial future. This bill would help by ensuring that as borrowers, there is someone on our side to help us navigate the abuses in the student lending system and ensure we never have to face those abuses. This bill puts in place so many things that could have helped me that will help others. I'm proud to serve in Robbinsdale. Please support this important legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. No other people signed up to testify, but is there any member of the public who wishes to testify to the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Brandt, the bill that you have, this committee is very familiar with, as you mentioned. Chair Stevenson carried this. And I'm not really going to speak so much to the bill specifically, but to avoid these kinds of situations, one of the things that I think we need to do, and I realize this is not an education committee, but it has a direct impact on things that this committee could have jurisdiction on, and that is employment and employment-related venues. Where am I going with this? Well, first of all, we don't always make options available to students in the high schools as far as all career choices are concerned. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the trades. They didn't ask me to, but I know that we are very short in the trades. Average plumber is about 57 right now in the state of Minnesota, and we are rapidly losing the baby boomer generation who was happy to be able to do those trades type related jobs. I've oftentimes suggested that if you're going to have a water heater problem or some other kind of unforeseen event happen, schedule in advance so that you can make sure that you get the help you need from the people in the trades to be able to get those things done. So once again, you're probably saying, how does that tie back into this bill? We track folks into areas by peer pressure and by what we put in front of students in school. Four-year college, four-year college, four-year college. I know that there are days that everyone in this room and everybody on this committee was glad to see their auto mechanic, was glad to see their plumber, was glad to see their electrician. The list goes on and on. These are great jobs. These are safe jobs. And these jobs pay very good money, very good money. And what happens is students get in this four-year track. And at their graduation parties, it's like, yeah, I'm going to go to college. Okay, great. They come home the first year. It's like, how'd it go? I was okay. By Thanksgiving in the second year, they've got thousands of dollars of debt. They come home and announce to their parents that they're leaving school, and now they're going to go to a trade school. And you know what they say? Why didn't I know about these options 3 or 4 years ago? So I could have avoided this additional debt. This is a multi-pronged issue, and getting back at school and working with those programs and working with the kids and working to show that there are opportunities, whether it be in the armed services or whether it be in the trades area or a lot of other good paying jobs and good paying areas that we should be supporting. It's absolutely what we should be looking at doing. We would lessen the need for your bill like you have today here, Representative. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Brandt, thank you very much for bringing this bill. I think, I just wanted to comment that there are a lot of reasons why education is expensive. I mean, even what our colleague here just suggested, that doesn't solve the problem for those who go to do accrue high debt. And there are a lot of systemic reasons why that is happening. But I think your bill is, it doesn't solve all of that. Of course, it's not intended to, but it certainly takes a crack at helping the consumer, helping the students who are often really outmatched by this very complex industry that, as the testimony indicated, is not always interested in their welfare. That is not, lenders are not necessarily there to help the student. And this is just an enormous problem, this student debt problem. I have to tell you, I have a sister, an older sister. She lives in another state, but she's still paying off her loans. And she's been working in a place where she's supposed to get the loan forgiveness, and she is also a victim of having not gotten good information. So it doesn't matter. You can be the most educated person. By definition, a lot of these people have gone to college, but still they are overmatched by this industry that is not looking out for them. And so I think this is a very, very good piece of the solution, and thank you very much for carrying the bill.
Thank you. I will give Representative Brandt the final word, but before that, I just want to say that I agree with a lot of what both Chair Liebling and Representative Driscoll said. And I think actually, Representative Driscoll's point, one of my favorite parts of this bill is Subdivision 3. Which instructs the loan advocate to come up with an education course to explain the basic mechanics of what student loans are. And while the bill as written doesn't say that has to go out to every, kid in high school or anything like that, I've always, and as has been alluded, I've carried this bill in the past, I've always imagined that that's the primary utility there, is to get people on the front end. Because I think there's a lot of people who take on student debt who don't understand what compound interest is, right? And that is not good. And so we need to teach people on the front end. Representative Driscoll is exactly right, though, about the need to get more education about the opportunities with the trades. I mean, I agree with that wholeheartedly, and I think this is a both-and situation. But anyway, Representative Brand, final word.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the final word. To your point, I agree. I would always want to be able to call a plumber or an electrician if needed, and I get that they're getting on the older side of life, and they're not going to be there forever, so we do need to backfill those jobs with new apprentices that can take over and become masters in their trades in the future. I will point out that a statistic, there are over 400,000 students currently enrolled in post-secondary education in Minnesota right now. And the total of the amount of student loans in Minnesota is about $29 billion. The most debt in Minnesota belongs to those that are between 35 and 49. And so we're talking about folks that are non-traditional students, maybe getting into a different job later on in life, maybe because of a shift or a difference of an employable job versus something else. I would also point out that about 30% of students under 35, and this is according to educationdata.org, drop out of college. But yet they still have debt. And to your point, Representative Driscoll, they also have a need for this as well. Final point I'll make is in the fiscal analysis of this bill, please do read it. But at the bottom of page 2, it says the department's assumption would result in about 500 complaints per year being resolved or taken care of as a result of this position. And so the need is there. And I couldn't thank you more for supporting the bill, and I hope to see it get to the finish line.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
We're at the end of our agenda. I'm going to look over at Representative Driscoll and give him the chance to ask the question, which I know is coming. Representative Driscoll.
If you were a tree, what kind of tree would you be? Oh, that wasn't the question. Mr. Chair, we've come to that time of the week again where we'd like to know what our work plan and schedule looks like next week. Can you provide us some guidance?
I would like to know, too, Representative Driscoll. I really would. We will be taking up bills on both Monday and Wednesday. As you know, I shared with you a list of some bills that I'm considering, and maybe you and I can chat a little bit after the hearing about some of those options. The one that I feel pretty confident in telling the committee that we'll take up on Monday is a bill by Representative Howard related to the prescription drug copays. Beyond that, I think I'm going to, discretion being the better part of valor, refrain from making a public commitment at this time. But we will have bills on both days. Representative Driscoll?
I will hang back after class and speak with the teacher.
With that, the meeting is adjourned.